devoted to the fastest growing segment of our society. To those of you like me who know that there's something dreadfully wrong, even destructive, about religion and politics, media reporting, military invasions, and economic schemes. We realize that the institution man has conceived are actually the problem. They're not just part of the problem, they are the problem. And they most certainly aren't the solution. We can't solve what ails us through new elections by praying to a religious God. So instead of merely presenting the news, our mission will be to understand what is causing the tragedies, who is behind them, why, what are they doing? The basic questions, so that we understand what is besieging our planet, who is doing it, whose interests are actually met by this constant siege of war, all while we predict how the events that we are witnessing will influence our world over the next 10 to 20 years. But in our second hour, we're going to change our tune dramatically, and we're going to engage God on His terms. Well, we're still going to use the same tools, evidence and reason, but we're going to consider His advice, His guidance, since His covenant provides hope, the lone hope in an exceedingly troubled world. If you'd like to engage in this discussion, our number is 877-300-7645. Scott and I were talking about 9/11, of course, the anniversary of 9/11 yesterday. Many of you may have watched some of the documentaries on it last night. I'd like to share a couple of thoughts on the Islamic suicide bombings of 9/11. One of those is that there was no reason for the government to respond by dehumanizing Americans, by essentially robbing Americans of their freedoms relative to flying. All that had to be done to stop 9/11 from happening was done in less than a month's time by the airlines themselves, something that was so subtle most people aren't even aware of it. But the cockpit doors that were very flimsy before, they were made out of typically aluminum and some very flimsy plastic coatings, you know, just trying to keep everything lightweight in an airplane. And typically those doors were kept open. But the door to the flight deck, to the cockpit of the airplane, was remade not only in Kevlar, but they reinforced the latching mechanisms such that there is no way for anyone to break into the cabin. You can't saw into the cabin. You can't shoot your way into the cabin. You can't pound your way into the cabin. There is nothing you can do. When that door is closed, there is nothing you can do to get into the cabin. Using commercial airliners as suicide bombers became impossible the moment they came up with the means to change those doors to Kevlar, so that they're impenetrable. That was it. You don't need to take an extra 2 hours out of the lives of ordinary Americans to dehumanize them through invasive searches. You don't have to breach your own constitution to do so. That was it. Now all a deranged Muslim can do is to bomb the airplane while they're flying in it. And, you know, we had the underwear bomber who tried to do that. He tried to light his britches on fire, and even if he had done so, he'd have burned up his seat. Maybe. He might have injured a person in front of him and behind him and to the side of him. Maybe. But the airlines have also reinforced the area between the cabin and the wings where the fuel is stored. So the Bonjinka bombing plot that was conceived by Ramzi Youssef, just like 9/11 was conceived by Ramzi Youssef, he's a guest of the U.S. government. I think it's in that Supermax prison in Colorado about 250 feet underground. That there is no reason for the airlines to infringe on your rights to carry your own cosmetics in normal-sized bottles because you're not going to get to the fuel tanks. Now, you can't make life totally safe from religious fanatics. But the odds under those cases of a religious fanatic doing something become so remote that the cost in terms of time and the infringement on your human rights, the dignity of humanity, it becomes a fairly easy trade-off in favor of let's treat people with respect again. Remember when flying an airplane used to be something you looked forward to? And now it's a horrendous experience, and it changed because of 9/11. The whole attitude of this country changed as a result of that.
I remember wanting to go fly. I remember not worrying about flying at all. I remember not even, you know, you would wear nice clothes. You'd want to dress up to go fly.
That's right. And you were treated nicely. I mean, the whole experience was designed. You were greeted at the curb with a smile. You checked in. The lines were short. You could get to the flight 30 minutes early. Everybody along the way was pleasant. They thanked you for choosing their airline. And they gave you food. And they gave you drink. And the whole experience, the captain would come out and talk to you. I mean, look what's happened.
Yeah, well, they used to give you peanuts and stuff like that, too. But, yeah, now when I go, I wear flip-flops and, you know, just the most basic stuff I can make because I don't want to give them reason to search me too aggressively.
Right. Yeah, it's a world that has changed, and it's changed without us coming to grips with what the actual problem was. And if you never get to the root of the problem, if you stop at Al-Qaeda did this when Al-Qaeda did not conceive the plot. They didn't staff the plot. Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with the Al-Qaeda mosque in Hamburg, Germany, which was the main resource for funneling jihadists into America. They didn't come up with the 9/11 plot. That plot was conceived entirely by Ramzi Youssef in the Philippines, the same fellow that taught the Oklahoma bombers how to make a fuel oil bomb. The same fellow that came up with the Bonjica plan, which was to mix chemicals to potentially blow up the fuel tanks mid-flight. Same guy. He wasn't a member of Al-Qaeda. In fact, his association in the Philippines was with Abu Sayyaf. So here we go to Al-Qaeda, and we blame them, without evidence, by the way. There's a reason that we never tried Osama bin Laden. There's a reason that he was not to be brought back alive to stand justice for his crime, but instead was killed. It's because there was no such evidence. They knew of it. They were happy about it. They didn't conceive the plan. They didn't staff the plan. They didn't even fund the plan. And so when you stop right there and you say, okay, we're going to go get them so we can go invade Afghanistan, making a bad situation worse there. And we don't bother to tell the American people. You know, America, the guy that conceived this plan is already in jail. We put him in jail because we convicted him of the first World Trade Center bombing. He's already in jail. There's no one else to go after here unless you want to deal with the religion that motivated it. But instead, no. Old Georgie Bush, he wanted to be a wartime president, so he had America invade Afghanistan. Became a new case of Vietnam. Now, America also didn't want to tell you that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that we were fighting in Afghanistan, the new enemy, that new enemy was America's enemy, that we conceived that enemy. We played the tape of that, of Zbigniew Brzezinski talking to them. We've talked about it so many times, how Zbigniew Brzezinski is the National Security Council for Jimmy Carter. Thought that it'd be a great scheme to give the Russians a taste of what they gave us in Vietnam, knowing that we fought a proxy war in Vietnam, which is stupid, but that we fight a proxy war in Afghanistan. We'll empower the Mujahideen, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. We'll give them the weapons. Well, they turned against us. That's what typically happens when you fight proxy wars. So didn't even bother to tell the American people that. Let's just go off and do this. And Americans had this tendency at the time to trust their political leaders. Bad mistake. And then at the very time the America was invading Afghanistan, even before we invaded, Wesley Clark has now demonstrated to us that this government decided that they would also invade Iraq. One of the great tragic, most suicidal mistakes in American history. Because by invading Iraq, we gave Iraq to Iran. We created this Syrian civil war, which is a proxy war now between the United States and Europe and China and Russia on the other side, between Sunni and Shia Islam. It's going to ultimately erupt into World War III. Terribly, tragically suicidal. And we enabled Iran to complete its nuclear ambitions. All because we didn't think of the consequences of our actions. Based on 9/11, we didn't recognize that Al-Qaeda was not the reason for 9/11. It's Islam. It's not a corruption of Islam. It's not Islamic extremists. It's not radical Islam. Just Islam. Matter of fact, it's the only form of the religion. Many people would say, oh, most Muslims are moderate, peace-loving people, and it's only these crazy ones, these extremists, the radicals, that are the jihadists. No, exactly the opposite is true. 100% of good Muslims, as defined by the Quran, are jihadists. It is only bad Muslims that can be peaceful. And the Quran specifically says that if a Muslim is peaceful, if they do not engage in jihad, you must kill them. Allah says that if a Muslim does not engage in jihad, which is defined exclusively as fighting with all effective arms, then he hates the hypocrite to the point that he personally is going to torture them in the hottest places in hell. It is a religion that corrupts everything it touches. There's a reason that Muslims kill Muslims by the hundreds of thousands. There's a reason that the first Muslims killed over 200 million people in their barbarian conquest of the world right after Muhammad's death. It's a reason that Muhammad led 75 ruthless terrorist raids. Islam is the most horrid of all religions. And sometime along the way, we need as a nation to figure out that the cause of 9/11 was Islam and deal with that. Deal with that using weapons that are much more effective against a religious enemy than bullets and bombs. Words wielded wisely will end the threat of Islamic terrorism. We'll return to Shattering Myths and to Nick, who was called in from Wisconsin, after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Nick on the line who has a question, I understand, about the Million Muslim March in Washington. Good alliteration, Million Muslim March has a good ring to it. Unfortunately, I think they only had about 50,000 people. Not good with the mathematics. Hi, Nick. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning. So I don't see it anywhere in the media or in the news. No one else talking about that. I came across on the Facebook something like that, and something, and I heard that bikers took over, that instead of a million Muslims, 800,000 bikers showed up, and they they were like romping, or I mean, they somehow canceled the Muslim march. And from what I read, I mean, everyone is like praising those bikers.
I heard about the Million Muslim March, it fizzled, and there were far less than 50,000 Muslims that showed up. There have never been 800,000 bikers in Washington at a time. When bikers come together, gather in large numbers, they usually do it around Glacier National Park up there I think it's in Montana that they do it. That's
disinformation,
pretty, disinformation, not the the case. But it is, this notion that is promoted in the media that the average Muslim is a really good fellow. They're contributing citizens. They treat the women in their lives wonderfully, and that they are good fathers and good providers, and just like the rest of us, trying to worship their God in the way that they have been taught.
Make ends meet, right?
Yeah, it's absolute and complete utter nonsense. The only way that you can be a decent human being and be a Muslim is for you to be a really bad Muslim. And if you were to, and there's this tendency amongst people to evaluate, and this was really rampant right after 9/11 occurred, and I was one of two or three people who had studied Islam and who could speak with a degree of authenticity about the nature of the Islamic Quran and Hadith and about the life of Muhammad and the fact that Islam was a terrorist manifesto. And I could prove that. And so many people would say, but I know a Muslim. He lives down the street, you know, and he seems like a normal person, so I don't believe you. And it's just astonishing how we have been conditioned to forego evidence and reason when the conclusions are undeniable, and instead prefer to cling to an impression that we have of someone. You know, when Goebbels and the other leading Nazis, even the those that were instrumental in the Final Solution in Germany, that when other Germans were asked about them, they would say, oh, you know, wonderful family. The yard was always immaculate. The kids were just as sweet as they could be. The wife, oh, she was so beautiful. And they would speak in the same way, as if outward appearances dictate what drives, what motivates people to do unbelievably heinous acts. You know, it's religion and politics that motivate people to be uncivilized, and we just don't seem to get it, which is my big concern of 9/11. Every program last night kept on saying, we'll never forget. Well, we never knew. How can we not forget? We never bothered to know.
At the same time, I believe the number one group of people that Muslims kill is Muslims.
Of course,
they kill other Muslims because they don't participate in the jihad.
Correct.
Because that's what the Quran tells them to do.
Well, it's not only because they don't participate in the jihad, and it is true that the Quran in the Ninth Surah tells Muslims to go kill all peaceful Muslims, because the Quran Ninth Surah defines a peaceful Muslim as a hypocrite and tells good Muslims to kill them so that Allah can torture them in hell. But the 33rd surah has this vicious verse encouraging terrorism. And it says, you know, that if any Muslim does not acquiesce to the goals of Islam at large, which is to continue to fight until the only religion on earth is Islam, that if they do not, that they should not be allowed to live in the community. And the Quran orders the jihadist Muslims then to go terrorize them, to viciously savage them, so ruthlessly that none ever again will dare oppose the jihadist goals of Islam, the world conquest of this religion. And so we need to understand what the documents that Islam is founded on actually say, and then we'll know what happened on 9/11. Good morning, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Nick on the line. We're talking about what happened on 9/11, because America is constantly repeating this idea that we'll never forget, and we constantly wrap ourselves in the flag, and we talk about how wonderful it is to be Americans. And the reality is, there's not one in 1,000 Americans that understands 9/11. Americans talk about 9/11 as if it was a terrorist strike. Terrorism is a tactic, folks. It's not an enemy. This notion that you're fighting the war against terrorism and that the United States has created this ongoing war is absolute poppycock. It is just stupid. If you buy into a war against terrorism, then you're unthinking, and they've won. They own you. That means that they can manipulate you any way they want to, because you're not thinking. Terrorists did not perpetrate 9/11. Now, if you're one of those 5 percenters, and we had a call at the end of the first hour yesterday about somebody that was convinced that the government aided and abetted 9/11 occurring, shame on you. I mean, it used to be that the conspiracy theorists had no airplanes flying into the Pentagon, and they had the government to put thermite on the beams in the Twin Towers. It's just preposterous stuff. And finally, when that those theories had been absolutely disintegrated in terms of being refuted, and just think of how impossible it would have been for the government to say, oh, yeah, you know, someday, you know, we've read the 9/11 plans from Ranzi Youssef, and rather than trying to thwart them, what we're going to do is we're going to aid and abet them, and we're going to put thermite on the beams in the offices on the upper floors in the World Trade Center, and we'll never be detected. They'll never know that we're doing it. They'll never find any investigation that we've done it, and this will be the perfect plan. That just flying planes at the buildings is not enough for us to be able to cause a perpetual state of war. Let's aid them. And that all the people that were engaged in it will be able to keep this secret. No problem at all. Well, they gave up on that after a while, and now there was a satellite building. You know, the World Trade Center complex had some smaller buildings that were associated with it. And one of the smaller buildings, and when the second tower fell, the enormous energy that was released by this 1,000-foot building collapsing upon itself with all of that external steel frame and all of the concrete and all of the you know, the weight of all of the floors and everything else, it just literally blew out the building that was next to it. And so there are now theories that focus strictly on that building. Not that they're willing to admit, okay, so Muslims flew planes into the two big towers. But there was a satellite building that the government had all prepped so it could fall too. And just think about that. I mean, okay, the two towers falling is not enough. What we're going to do is, okay, we'll let the Muslims fly planes into those buildings, but we'll take down a tower on our own just for good measure. The stupidity of all of that. Where's your mind? And when you have people boisterously proposing things like this, what it does is it takes us away from the truth. The truth is that Islam is a barbaric religion. It was conceived by the most repulsive man who ever lived, Muhammad. By his own admission, by his own diary, by his own biography, I should say, by the history of Islam, by the testimony that's in the Quran and the Hadith, he was a rapist. He was incestuous. He was a pedophile. He was a terrorist, having led and inspired 75 terrorist raids in the first 10 years of the Islamic era. He was a mass murderer. He was sadistic. He was an acknowledged liar. He was a thief. He was a slave trader. He was a kidnapper for ransom. Anything that you can name that is heinous, he did. And his Quran is easily the worst book ever written. It has no context. It has no chronology. It is grotesquely immoral. And rather than deal with the fact that it was Islam that inspired 9/11, and that the 19 Muslims, most of whom were indoctrinated in the mosques of Saudi Arabia, flew planes into our buildings as suicide bombers, which is the trademark of Islam, to lash out at America because they viewed America as the enemy of Islam, to view anything different than that, then you're missing the whole point. Then it's not something that you can't say that we'll never forget because you never understood. Now, once you know that it was the religion of Islam that inspired and motivated Muslims to fly planes into our buildings as suicide bombers, then you're in a position to deal with that. And you can never effectively defeat a religious ideal with bullets and bombs. Political ideals, sometimes, although they never really seem to die. Look at the neo-Nazis. They're now raising hell throughout Europe. In fact, neo-Nazi sentiments are actually the majority of sentiments in many European countries. We now have about two-thirds of Europeans siding with neo-Nazi belief systems. There's only one way to effectively curtail the barbarian nature of a religion. It's desire to kill all of those who don't go along with it. There's only one way. If you want to stop the carnage in Syria, the carnage in Iraq, the carnage in Libya, the carnage in Egypt, the carnage that Muslims export on occasion through attacks like Oklahoma City and 9/11, if you wish to do that, there's only one way to do it. There's only one tool that can ever be effectively wielded at religion. It's the same tool that Yahweh, the author of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, wielded at religion. Evidence and reason. Expose them for who they are. When the world and leaders around the world, those with platforms where people will listen, take the time to study the nature of Muhammad and the nature of the Islamic religion, then it becomes impossible for them to recruit in any country where free choice exists. And then the only issue is the countries that are personal estates, the countries like Saudi Arabia that are dictatorships. But once you come to know that the driving force of those countries is this demented, this savage, this terrorist religion, then you're in an entirely different position as to how you deal with them. So words wielded wisely in the United States and Europe would preclude those countries from buying oil from Islamic countries. It would cause them, rather than waging war against those Islamic countries and squandering, as the United States did, $4 to $6 trillion, to use a fraction of that money to develop those nations' own energy reserves, while using another fraction of that money to develop alternatives to existing energy sources. And then you're in a position you don't need their oil. If you don't have their oil, if you don't buy their oil, they cease to exist because there has never been a vibrant economy in an Islamic country. Because Islam squelches the kind of fervor that is necessary to build an economy worth living in. You know, Muslims became terrorists. They became jihadists during Muhammad's life and after his life because all they could do, all they knew how to do, was to be pirates. That's what drove their economy, was savaging others and stealing from them. It was the same economy that drove Genghis and Kublai Khan, thriving as parasites off the lifeblood of others. So if we simply recognize that the problem is Islam, denounce the religion, using its own scriptures, do what is written in Prophet of Doom. Prophet of Doom is based solely on the five earliest Islamic sources. It exposes those sources for what they actually say. It takes the Quran, puts it into the context of Muhammad's life, rearranges it chronologically based upon the two historical chronological hadith collections. That's all you have to do. Get people to read it. Read it yourself. Share it with others. And then two things change. It becomes impossible for Muslims to recruit more Muslims or to even motivate Muslims in free countries. And then the Islamic fiefdoms, once the West stops buying their oil, because you recognize you can't fuel this monster, then Islam loses its ability to export its terror. It's really that simple. It's always been that simple. Had we responded appropriately to 9/11, but now, 12 years ago, there would be no Islamic terrorism today. It would be over. None. That's all we needed to do. But what did we do instead? We declared war against a tactic. And we have been fighting an unending war ever since that time. So let me share with you again what Thomas Jefferson wrote about this, because he was right. And Americans don't get it. Now, I read this yesterday. The statement that Jefferson made was written in what he called his answers to Jean-Baptiste de Menet. Now, this gentleman that he was responding to was not your average schlub. No. For those who are interested, you know, Google the name, Jean-Baptiste de Menet. Now, it's a French name, so it's not written as it is pronounced. The E is silent, the S is silent, and the R is silent. It's M-E-U-S-N-I-E-R. He was one of the most famous of all French generals. In fact, he is so famous as a general in France that his name is one of those written on the Arc de Triomphe. So, Jefferson, answering questions written to him by this man who is also one of the greatest mathematicians of any age. He was also an engineer and a great inventor. Jefferson, not on his own, but also in conjunction with Madison, the primary architect of the United States Constitution, and of course the writer of the Declaration of Independence, they wrote answers to this man, and we'll consider them in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The United States has engaged in a perpetual state of war and has built the world's largest military. In fact, a military so large, it is larger than the rest of the world's militaries combined. And it has done so at great expense to its citizens. And it's done so even though one of the nation's founding fathers, probably the most brilliant mind of the 18th century, even though he warned us not to do this, we did it anyway. We built a monument to him in Washington, D.C., and then we did exactly what he warned us against. So in his letters to Jean-Baptiste de Menet, he wrote as follows. Of all of the enemies to public liberty, war is, perhaps, the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other threat. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the dominion of the few. In war, discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments, which are payments, is multiplied. And all of the means of seducing minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequity of fortunes and the opportunities for fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals, all being endangered therein. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. That is a statement more eloquent, more reasoned, more powerful than the Gettysburg Address. It's more reasoned, more powerful, more eloquent than anything written in the Declaration of Independence or in the United States Constitution. I have long stated that America would be better off without its military. That if America had no military at all, and simply honored the provisions of the Second Amendment, then it would be impossible for any country to invade and occupy the country. And it would be impossible for the government of this country to impose its tyranny on the people, depriving them of their rights through taxation and debt and standing armies. And for those of you who say, you know, if you had that many weapons in the hands of average citizens, oh, can you imagine the crime and the murder? Well, there's a little known fact. As gun ownership has gone up, murders with guns have gone down. Not just a little bit, dramatically. Jefferson knew that was the greatest threat to America. A perpetual state of war and a standing army. He was right. We have destroyed ourselves as a result. We've engaged in all manner of foolishness. Just think what we did to ourselves in the Civil War. Just think what we did to ourselves on behalf of a banker in World War I. Just think of how we responded to Pearl Harbor, where 3,000 servicemen were killed because, well, we had a standing military. And we sacrificed 350,000 more Americans to avenge the death of 3,000. Just think of that. Think of the foolishness of what we did following 9/11, where we invaded Afghanistan based on lies. Where we invaded Iraq based upon lies. All why? Because we could. So here again, I want us to begin to think, why did Jefferson warn us that the greatest evil of all, the greatest thing to be feared, if in fact you are concerned about your freedom, is a standing army and a perpetual, continual state of war? Because it gives the government the ability to confiscate your earnings. It gives the government the platform to seduce you with propaganda. It gives the government the ability to go into debt to destroy the nation's future. Don't allow them to do it. Stand up against it.